You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Canada has been a leading force in the war in Afghanistan since its start in 2001. Both the Liberal and Conservative governments committed thousands of troops and billions of dollars to the war effort. After a decade of conflict, there is considerable debate about the efficacy of the mission, as well as a need to reassess Canada's role in the war. A new collection of essays has just been published from the University of Toronto Press. Empire's Ally provides a very critical look at the political economy of war-making in general and Canada's foreign policy in Afghanistan in particular. Several contributors spoke at Simon Fraser University Harbour Centre last month to mark the launch of the book. In this first segment, we're going to hear from Greg Albo and Michael Skinner. Greg Albo is professor of political science at York University and is also the co-editor of Empire's Ally. And Michael Skinner is a researcher at the York Center for International and Security Studies, as well as a doctoral candidate in political science, also at York University.
The origins of the book itself date back specifically to 2008 with the question of the surge and the notion that this was going to defeat the resistance and we were soon going to be in a different phase of the war. And we were thinking at the time that that was doubtful and how to put this in the wider context of what was going on in Canada under Harper, the way he had built on rather than simply transformed the changes that had occurred with Martin and Chrétien, and put it also in the larger context of a range of interventions that had been occurring on the part of the Canadian state. Derek just mentioned the Haiti case that Anthony and he and others have written about, but there was also the intervention in Honduras, which was more diplomatic than military. There's the forms of the military and policing deployment that Canada's engaged in the West Bank, and the way that also Canada had reacted to the war in Lebanon, between Israel and Lebanon. So we wanted a project that would properly dissect this phase of Canadian imperialism and attempt to understand in a more substantial way the transformations that had been occurring in the Canadian state. And that was really our initial objective. There are a few key themes that I want to stress come across in the book and that we try to make to raise across the essays. One of the challenges we had and that we decided to focus on is that people were looking at the conflict in the Middle East in a divided way, that is, looking at Palestine here, Egypt there, some issues of dealing with the Gulf there, and the Afghanistan war somewhere else. And the theme that we wanted to raise in the book is this was best looked at as a single war from Palestine to Afghanistan. And it had a lot to do with a longer-term strategy that NATO and the U.S. powers had been attempting to discipline and integrate that zone of the world into world capitalism, and particularly to attempt to open up new vistas for accumulation in those areas, which was particularly a key aspect of gaining control, as it has been for several centuries, of Afghanistan. So that was a key theme that we wanted to make. Within that, it was absolutely essential that we raise the particular role that Canada was playing in this, not simply as a follower, but as an independent actor. Certainly not the power when we're dealing with the U.S., but a very important secondary imperialist state with interests of its own in relationship to these developments. And it was important to see that the issues that were forming in relationship to NATO, the backing of the U.S. primacy position, the Bush doctrine was all being supported on Canada, not simply as a follower, but also in the interests of Canada in pursuing its own imperial interests around the world. I think that theme has been proven right in terms of looking at the trajectory of the war and the forms of intervention. But I also think it was right in that the single war theme and the linking of it to the primacy doctrine that the U.S. was pushing, and then specifically the sanction, the U.S. sanction to war that was passed in 2001, was the notion that this was putting the U.S. on a stance of endless war, as they're now calling it in the hearings. They openly call it now in the hearings that were just held in May in Washington. That's the stance of Obama, and that's the stance that we were arguing that that this was the vision that we had to look at what was going on. A second theme that we wanted to raise was how the Afghanistan intervention related to this particular phase of Canadian imperialism. And especially this was, we had to understand that the internationalization of Canadian capital was at a very different phase than much earlier. It was much more aggressive in terms of its intervention or its investments in a lot of areas. Those investments were being backed by the Canadian state. In many cases, that wasn't simply the diplomatic forms of the Canadian state, but also had to do with the military apparatuses of the Canadian state. And this had developed in Canada a particular way that its diplomatic and military doctrines were following. I summarize it as some notion of cooperative specialization. That is, Canada was developing across its international apparatus the notion that it would be cooperating systematically with the U.S., and developing particular specializations where Canada could intervene. This included the special forces that would intervene around the world, the particular specializations that Canada would have. But it was also doing it on the basis of its own imperial interests and its own capacities. The third theme that is raised across the essays has to do with the nature of war deployment and the restructuring of the Canadian state. When we look at what occurred, this occurs over a couple of phases. One is the restructuring that occurred with NAFTA and neoliberalism through the 1990s with Chrétien and Martin. And post 9/11, it had to do with the way that the restructuring of the state apparatuses occurred, raising the importance of the coercive and military apparatuses, decreasing the relative importance of the diplomatic apparatuses, except in terms of trade. It was the way that the military and security doctrines were systematically remade in Canada. That had the effect of reworking internal policing and security doctrines in Canada. It was the way that the whole government was reoriented in the so-called, what the Chrétien-Martin governments called the 3D approach, which Harper calls the whole of government approach. That is the way development, diplomatic, and defense policies would be mobilized to support Canada's international interventions, in particular when it was deploying troops. That was an important theme that we wanted to raise. A fourth one was the theme that was only coming out of the peace movement, and that the rest of the Canadian state, including the political parties, were denying, and that was that the war could not be won on the terms set out by the U.S., NATO, and the Canadian propaganda, and that this would only lead to wider regional instability and increasing militarism at home. And the final one was that the one that dealt with the peace movement, but also where we are in building a new left, the next left in Canada. And that is that the Canadian anti-war movement needs to also be seen as an anti-imperialist movement and be a key component of an alternative view of world order. I'm just going to finish by reading two short passages that try to capture exactly some of the themes that we have. One of them is from the preface from Jerome and I, which deals with the way that we insist that the Canadian state had to be seen. Canada's war has represented the imperial policy of a secondary state in the U.S.-led empire of capital. More than this, it has been linked to a capitalist class strategy within the Canadian state to build and advance a policy of global militarism in line with the deep integration of the North American bloc and the internationalization of Canadian capital. If I do say so myself, I think that thesis is pretty much, in Canadian foreign policy discussions, unique to this book. The second passage I want to read is from my own essay, which deals with Canadian foreign policy and the transformation since 2001, and the agenda that is partly cut out for us in the peace movement, anti-war activists, and on the Canadian left. Indeed, the belief that Canadian foreign policy has been or can be a force for a more just or balanced world has been one of the most crippling illusions of political life in Canada, particularly in progressive circles. This illusion has shielded from scrutiny the reality of Canada as an imperialist power and its particular role as an ally of the U.S. project of asserting primacy and expanding capitalism globally. The restructuring of Canadian foreign policy over the past decade, and in particular the Canadian intervention in Afghanistan, has played no small part in revealing these illusions for what they are. They make clear the need for more radical departures in Canadian politics and the reclaiming of a vision of democratic socialism if a more just, peaceful, and egalitarian foreign policy is to be found. I'm going to turn it over to my other contributors who will expound on these themes and probably at times challenge me in turn. Thank you.
Well, as Greg said, the first time I went to Afghanistan, I really wasn't a part of my research. I was doing work in Guatemala, actually, not Honduras, but door in Guatemala. And I was asked by Angela Joya, actually one of the co-authors, contributors in the book, to help work on a project she was putting together in Afghanistan, which was intended to be a film documentary, which never occurred because we just never could get anyone that wanted to spend any money on it. And what I did with my Afghan-Canadian research partner, Hamid Raskar, is we traveled throughout Afghanistan with a video camera asking Afghans what they thought about the international intervention. And what we found was that vast majority of Afghans we asked that question were highly skeptical that we were there to liberate Afghan women. They were highly skeptical that we were there to somehow bring democracy to Afghans, particularly since Afghans had a functional democracy. Once they drove the British out in 1919, to end the Third Anglo-Afghan War, they established a constitutional monarchy, which was reasonably effective, far from perfect, but reasonably effective up until after the Second World War in the Cold War era, when Afghanistan became extremely important in the Cold War battles between the U.S. and the Soviets, first in development following the First World War, or the Second World War, and finally deteriorated to the point of actual warfare and beginning in the late 1970s, which there's been nonstop war now since 1979. Now, why is Afghanistan important? I mean, we're told it's important because terrorists live there who threaten our very civilization. But Afghanistan has been important for a long time. It's been important for millennia. It was a land bridge bridging Eurasia for millennia. The Afghans were exporting copper to the Egyptian pharaohs thousands of years ago. Afghanistan really lost importance during the great age of sea trade from the 16th century onwards. And then the great game between the Russians and the British, Afghanistan then went from becoming a land bridge and a highway to becoming a barrier for several centuries, first between the Russians and the British, and later between the Americans and the Soviets. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, Afghanistan was again seen as being a new frontier, a place where all the railways had ended at the Afghan border, all the highways had ended at the Afghan border, but there's great wealth in the region and great wealth within Afghanistan itself that's unexploited. As great capitalists, we need to exploit that wealth, open up those transportation corridors. And this was all talked about in the 1990s. In fact, in 1997, the U.S. introduced the first Silk Road Strategy Act, and a second act was introduced in 1999, neither of which passed, but showed an example of what the strategic thinking was at the time. When I was asking Afghans in 2007 why they thought we were there, I compiled a whole long list of geopolitical and economic reasons, which on the face of it all seemed to make a lot of sense, but I hadn't done the research to back them up, see if I could actually disprove or prove those theories. Certainly, opening up the Silk Road was one of the primary reasons of this long list. In addition, I mean, we're making money in our military-industrial complex. The Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries, CADSI is the acronym, just in the time I've been looking at it since 2007, when they had 500 members and they claimed to have to generate about $8 billion for the Canadian economy. The last time I looked a few days ago at their website, they have 950 members and they're generating $12.5 billion. Hmm. So we're making money from warfare. Afghans were very concerned that we were there to steal their resources. And I thought, Afghan resources, what? It's a dust bowl. That's what we see on the news. At the time I was there, 2007, the United States government was reporting that there might be $60 to $250 million worth of resources in total in Afghanistan to be exploited. That's what they were stating publicly. When I got there, an Afghan geologist took me out and took me for a little tour around a few places, and he said, there's probably $30 to $50 billion worth of copper over there and $50 to $100 billion worth of iron ore over there and on and on. And I came back and started talking about that. People thought I was crazy. A few years later, in 2010, the New York Times headline was that all of a sudden we've discovered $1 trillion worth of resources in Afghanistan, and some analysts put it at $3 trillion. But that's not enough to go to war for, to steal $3 trillion worth of resources. I mean, the Americans spent almost $1 trillion on the global war on terror. But an even bigger project is this new Silk Road Initiative. And again, I mean, I came back in 2007 and I said, Afghans are quite skeptical because they're talking about the new Silk Road. And people looked at me, what new Silk Road? How do you put railways through mountains? Well, we did it in the 19th century. And it's going to happen in Afghanistan. In 2011, Hillary Clinton announced the new Silk Road Initiative officially. And the issue that I'm looking at is, and again, this is where Greg's talking about the global war. And the global war on terror officially is from the Caribbean and Latin America to the Philippines, if you actually look at the documents, the American documents. It's even beyond what you're talking about from Palestine to Afghanistan. If we look at American foreign policy and look at it closely, what we really see is that it's really focused on two things: expanding global free trade and securing investors' interests. That's really what's there in all the U.S. national security strategies, U.S. defense strategy. It's really about expanding global free trade. And there's a two-track strategy that's there: engagement and containment. So containment is really the old-style Cold War. You know, we have to block our potential enemies off militarily. And, I mean, we often see in the news China is being purported as the great potential enemy. China is going to surpass us economically, and we really have to be afraid of China in certain ways. But there's also the policy of engagement, which is engaging in commercial economic activities, expanding free trade. So there's a bit of a contradiction in these in some ways, but at the same time, it's a focused foreign policy. In terms of the new Silk Road strategy, it's really a preemptive strategy to get into the region before Chinese, Russians, Indians, and particularly Iran, because Iran has actually been the most successful up to this point in building railways into Afghanistan. So it's on a global geopolitical scale that's really quite hard to fathom. And yet I found that Afghans, who in many cases were calling, if not stupid, illiterate, and yet they understand this. I mean, they were teaching me about this. It wasn't the other way around. It's interesting, looking at American foreign policy, what was called the Bush Doctrine is actually about a 90-page document called the National Security Strategy of 2002. And the central focus in that document was missed, because when the media reported on it, they talked about the preemptive warfare as being the Bush Doctrine. But preemptive warfare has always been a part of American policy. And besides, preemptive warfare is just a tactic. It's not the policy. What no one reported on was that Chapter 4 in the National Security Strategy, the title of it is Ignite a New Era of Global Economic Growth Through Free Markets and Free Trade. The document was about establishing free trade on a global basis. The tactic of preemptive warfare is the tactic of being able to implement that policy of expanding free trade. Okay, time flies when you're up here. So I'm going to wrap up on this issue of establishing free trade and the establishment of the new Silk Road. I mean, Afghans were quite clear that they really thought we were there for this huge development project, which is building railways, highways, all sorts of transportation, as well as communications corridors, energy transmission corridors. I mean, we've heard about a few of the projects, like the TAPI pipeline, but there's much more in the works. The Asian Development Bank, which most people probably don't realize, Canada is the largest shareholder, along with Japan, in the Asian Development Bank, started a program in 2001 of building 6 transportation, communications, and energy transmission corridors linking the Eurasian supercontinent. And those 6 corridors, all 6 have to go through Afghanistan to be viable. So Afghanistan has again taken its place as being really central to Eurasian geopolitics and consequently global geopolitics. It's an incredibly important place. I mean, it's not just some dust bowl on the edge of the world, and it's not a dust bowl either. I think most of the media we see is taken either within Kandahar Air Force Base or within 2 or 3 miles of Kandahar Air Force Base. That's not the Afghanistan that I saw, which is incredibly productive and full of very productive people who are threatened. I mean, I'm not an anti-development. I'm not anti-development. I mean, these developments could actually be very beneficial. But as we've seen throughout the history of development, there's always winners and losers. Most Afghans are going to lose. The laws that are in place to compensate for displaced people who will inevitably be displaced by the huge mining projects, the huge development projects, essentially adds up to we'll put you on a truck, give you a ride somewhere else, and give you $5. So there's big losers. So it's really not surprising that the level of resistance that we're seeing in Afghanistan is occurring. It's portrayed as a bunch of wacky Muslims who are religious fundamentalists and hate us because of whatever it is that we do that they don't like. There's so much more to what's really gone on, and that's not the Afghans that's not what I heard from Afghans, that they didn't hate me because I'm a white guy. They hate my country's government because they see it killing Afghans and see a much bigger picture than we're being given in the media here. So what we're seeing is really industrial development versus human development. There's now tens and very soon hundreds of billions of dollars going into industrial development projects, and we've seen a trickle that goes into actual human development projects. what we're really seeing in terms of a freedom and the Operation Enduring Freedom invasion force is that it's a guarantee of freedom and security for investors, but it's really at the expense of most Afghans, and it's at the expense of most of us, because we're paying for the security costs through our taxes, and certainly many Canadians are paying through it through blood and the loss of their family members. Thank you.
You're listening to a talk presented by several contributors to Empire's Ally, a new collection of essays reviewing Canada's role in the war in Afghanistan over the past decade. And next we're going to hear from Paul Kellogg, Anthony Fenton, and Derek O'Keefe. Paul Kellogg is assistant professor with the Athabasca University Masters of Arts Integrated Studies Program. Anthony Fenton is an independent author and journalist, as well as a PhD candidate in the Political Science Department at York University. And lastly, Derek O'Keefe is co-chair of the Canadian Peace Alliance, as well as a co-host here on Co-op Radio on the Media Morning Show.
I'll speak a bit about mostly about my chapter. The chapter that I wrote in the book is called From the Avro to Afghanistan, the Avro Arrow, Towards a Political Economy of Canada's New Militarism. But I also want to pick up on Greg's theme and say a couple of minutes on Adam Haniya's chapter about a single war, because I think that that's an important connecting thread through the whole book. It's something that has implications both theoretically and practically in terms of the anti-war movement. In terms of the chapter that I contributed to the book, it has to do with sort of grappling with an imaginary that is often present about Canada. An imaginary that, you know, it's really bad now under Harper. Well, that's not an imaginary. That's just real. Okay, but so it's really bad now under Harper. But we imagine this time when it was better. Canada used to be a peacekeeper. We used to be the good people. We had the blue helmets on. And we did good things. And now we're doing bad things. And how do we get back to that time when we did good things as opposed to the bad things? I'm not saying I'm opposed to doing good things, but I think it's not so simple. I think that imaginary that we had, that peacekeeping moment, and there was a peacekeeping moment. There was a moment when Canada was preeminently identified with the Blue Helmets. From 1956, you can identify it precisely. From 1956, with the Suez Crisis and Lester Pearson coming up with this notion and all the rest of it, but it's ended a long time ago. It actually ended it didn't end with the Afghanistan War, it ended in 1991. It ended in 1991 with Canada's open involvement in the war against Iraq in that moment. And the problem is that there's a deep capitalist political economy logic to both the peacekeeping moment and the new militarism that we're seeing now. So, and I think the reason the Avro Arrow fits into the title, just because it starts with the letter A, but also I think the Avro Arrow was a fighter bomber jet that was being developed independently in Canada. It was going to be a Canadian, you know, hooray, we've got a Canadian bomber plane. The napalm in Vietnam could be a Canadian napalm. Isn't that fantastic? It was canceled by the Diefenbaker Tory government. And I think that's a critical moment in terms of reshaping an aspect of Canadian political economy that I think that's one of the turning points in this story. So, what is the political economy logic behind this? Go back to the 1950s. We know of the U.S. as a warfare state. The United States is a warfare state. This is not news. You know, the United States budget, its central government budget, at this moment in time, about 20% of it, of the budget that we know about, goes to the military. That compares to about 6 or 7% of the budget in Canada. At the peak of the Korean War, 70% of the money spent by the U.S. federal government, was spent on the war machine. 7 cents out of every 10 cents, 70 cents out of every dollar. It's an extraordinary sum of money. It's actually unimaginable in terms of what this means in terms of public policy and what a government, what's a government there to do? We pay tax dollars, they bomb people. That's the essential relationship. We shouldn't be too smug about this in Canada, though, because at the peak of the Korean War, it wasn't as high in Canada, but the figure is 40%. 40% of Ottawa's budget at the peak of the Korean War went towards war making. So Canada was a warfare state in the 1950s. And coming out of World War II, this is not surprising. At the end of World War II, Canada is the fourth biggest military power in the world left standing. It's a significant player in the world. It's a key player in the formation of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's part of Canadian diplomatic evangelism and all the rest of it. It changes. There's a divergence through the 60s and 70s. Through the 60s and 70s, there's a gradual decline in the amount of money being devoted to warfare in the Canadian budget. It declines at a much faster level than it does in the United States. The United States remains, of course, the world's biggest imperial power with a massive commitment to, for almost half of the world's military spending is done by the United States to this day. And in that moment of the 60s and 70s, that's when there is also the creation in Canada of a welfare state. In a certain sense, you could think about it this way. There seems to be an evolution. United States remains as a warfare state, and Canada evolves in more of a welfare state direction. Don't want to exaggerate it. There's lots of problems and all the rest of it. But it is, if you've been in the United States, you know that. Just the example of Medicare. It's a huge difference in Canada and the United States. We can't think of this just as politics. It was economic. These are economic categories, warfare state and welfare state. Now, one of the economic categories of the warfare state is straightforward. A lot of the benefits to empire. If you got a big gun, you can get a lot of stuff. You can get a lot of gold out of Potosí in Bolivia and get a lot of, you know, there is an economic benefit to empire. But there's also an economic cost to empire. There's an economic cost to sustaining the welfare state. And I think that one of the reasons you've got this long decline in the United States over 40 and 50 years is because they have sustained this massive commitment to warfare at the expense of many other aspects of their economy. Welfare state is also an economic category. It's not just a political category. I don't have time to go into it, but I think for us as social movement activists, it's very important. Everyone thinks, or not everyone, most people think of money spent on health, education, and welfare as a drain on the tax. You know, look at the crisis. We're spending so much money on health care. It is actually an extraordinarily effective economic development strategy to build hospitals, schools, and childcare centers. If you take care of human capital, you take care of the economy, and the evidence for this is actually overwhelming. In the course of a really good development strategy is to develop things that help people. You actually get a better society, it's all the rest of it. Now, why was Canada able to do this? It wasn't out of the goodness of Canada's heart. The empire that the United States protected with its warfare state was shared by Canada. Canadian capitalism lived under the military umbrella of the United States in the Caribbean, in Central America, in Latin America, increasingly in Africa as well, but they didn't have to pay the cost of it. You go to the English-speaking Caribbean and you say, who are the evil bankers? They don't say an American bank, they say the Bank of Nova Scotia, the Bank of Montreal, TD Bank. They say the evil Canadian banks that are dealing with us. That was made possible. That was an area kept safe for capitalism by military interventions over and over again. And I call that military parasitism. Canadian capitalism was a military parasite, but the situation has changed. Think of 1991. The United States is much more powerful in 1991 than it is in 2003. 1991 has got the muscle to force Japan and Saudi Arabia to pay for its war. That's what it did. Japan and Saudi Arabia paid for the war in Iraq in 1991. In 2003, it had the coalition of the disgruntled. You know, it couldn't. Many of its old allies said, no, we're not going to go. United States didn't have the same muscle. That's the background for what, it's a very interesting word, cooperative specialization, the term that Reger introduced here. Canada has to play a greater role in the cooperative specialization of keeping the world safe, keeping our little sphere safe for capitalism. There's pressure, in other words. There's a need for Canadian capitalism to pony up more in terms of military spending than it has in the past. And that, I think, is the political economy background to the new militarism that we are seeing today in Canada. And it's not Tory militarism. It's not Harper. It started under Chrétien. It started under the Liberals. I predict that we will see, if we see Justin Trudeau as a Liberal Prime Minister of Canada, that we will see him with a hard hat, with a helmet on, in a tank, promoting Canadian military. That's what we will see. It's Tory and Liberal militarism as well. It's a logic deeply embedded in the privileges of empire. Because it means that if this is true, and there's a deep political economy logic to the new militarism of the Canadian state, a capitalist logic, then there is a necessity, if you're going to be seriously anti-war, of also being anti-capitalist at the same time. You actually have to see the way in which these two things fit together in a very nasty, it's a very nasty concoction that's hard, you can't separate the two out. A minute and a half on Adam Hanea is a really important chapter. He can't be here. He teaches over in Britain now. It's an extremely important chapter. And he says, look, we had Iraq. We had Afghanistan. We had Palestine. We've had the 21st century in the Middle East and Central Asia has been a cauldron of violence. But we can't really see them as Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestine. They are very tightly interconnected. It's one war about keeping the Middle East and Central Asia as a space for capital accumulation in the interest of the big powers. Why is this important? If it's one war from their side, United States, Canada, Britain, etc., then it has to be one anti-war movement from our side. The importance of deeply connecting the anti-war movement in Afghanistan and Iraq with the resistance of the Palestinians against the violence that comes from the Israeli state, which is a client state of the United States in the region. This has been difficult in the anti-war movement. I don't know about the situation in Vancouver, but it's been difficult. The difficult issue, there's been always pressures to separate them, keep them separate, keep them apart, because we'll tick people off. People get upset when you raise Palestine. The NDP leaders get upset when you raise Palestine. We have to say we're going to deal with it. Against their unified war, we need a unified anti-war movement, even if that involves very, very many difficult political arguments. Anyway, that's what I'll say. Thanks for having us here, and we'll talk after the meeting.
We attempted to contextualize and capture sort of a snapshot of this particular coin juncture, if you will, counterinsurgency conjuncture, which saw the coming together of two emergent dynamics within the Canadian state's internationalizing arsenal. That of, on the one hand, of so-called democracy promotion and that of counterinsurgency warfare. As the title suggests, how the Canadian state has set about and is still setting about building an expeditionary force for whether you want to call it democracy promotion, we could set that aside and call it capitalist democracy, neoliberal democracy. But basically, it actually develops a theme that Greg mentioned and that Paul reiterated of cooperative specialization, or we call, you know, niche capabilities and capacities in both of these areas developed by the Canadian state for the foreseeable future, sort of for this new method of warfare. In other words, building an expeditionary force for the Canadian state and global capitalism, and of course, as Empire's ally, the interests of the United States. So the institutionalizing so-called democracy promotion as a core priority of Canadian foreign policy has coincided with the transformation of the Canadian military into an expeditionary force. The part of the chapter we spend trying to describe how Canada sort of built this capacity for democracy promotion dovetails with this period that Paul was describing, you know, sort of post-immediate, late Cold War, post-Cold War moment, and then this expeditionary moment that has continued to the present day. So this democracy we're talking about in the chapter, we call it, described as another name for polyarchy, a distinct form of elite rule that performs the function of legitimating existing inequalities, but does so more effectively than authoritarianism could. We briefly describe how democracy promotion evolved in Canadian foreign policy from this end of the Cold War period up to Afghanistan. One of the critical moments was under Brian Mulroney when he gave the seminal speech at Stanford University in 1991, where he says, "The world looks to the U.S. for leadership on the integration of newly emerging democracies into the global economy." And he said that Canada will fulfill every single one of its obligations to this program. And this is a really nascent effort that he set up then. And it's very interesting that many of the institutions that we refer to in the chapter have since, in the last couple of years alone, just become defunct. They've been eliminated by the Harper government. Rights and Democracy is one of them. The Canadian Foundation for the Americas, another one of them. Many of us in the room should be happy about these developments, not necessarily applauding the Conservatives per se, and then the reasons for which they axed these programs may differ from our demands that they axed them back in mid-2000s. But in any case, they are gutting them, and we look at this democracy promotion as it unfolds. In another section, we look at the organic intellectuals of polyarchy. There's been a number of Canadians who have worked from within the U.S. democracy promotion apparatus. And here we're talking about agencies like the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, and so on and so forth. And a number of them have come back to Canada to try and push from within the Canadian state for the development of a sort of a uniquely Canadian capacity for global democracy promotion. But I'm really brushing over this. We go into some detail here, and probably not enough detail that I would like, but of course the space limitations in the chapter limited us. But then we move on to sort of how this question of democracy promotion increasingly became conflated with the Afghan adventure in around 2005-2006. So you had, for example, the CEO or the president of a Canadian International Development Agency, Robert Greenhill, saying to Parliament that Afghanistan was a great example of where democracy and development go hand in hand. So we saw the increasing conflation in policy and intellectual circles of counterinsurgency with democracy. And then in the chapter, we next move to the military side of this, and we look at operational counterinsurgency. We introduced the Strategic Advisory Team Afghanistan, or SAT-A, as it became known with its acronym, as we call it, an important initial operating model for the type of expeditionary democracy promotion that Canada has been developing. And the SAT-A basically was comprised of 15 Canadian Forces personnel who were core planning experts who would be used to develop strategic-level advice for the government of Afghanistan. So they were embedded in the highest offices just below the level of the minister, basically had the ear of all the Afghan ministers and the key ministries, and had the ear of Karzai himself. This was set up by our old friend General Rick Hillier as a very unique arrangement. It wasn't part of ISAF. It wasn't part of Operation Enduring Freedom. It was a bilateral arrangement independent of these two things. And this gave Canada what they call a lot of political capital. So basically, Canada, through this strategic advisory team, Canada built a superb reputation and gave us, I'm quoting here, a member of that strategic advisory team that I interviewed a few years back, that this gave Canada a lot of capital in Kabul. And as we'll see in my later comments, how this gave Canada a lot of political capital that they were able to leverage in other parts of the world. To cite one thing, but there's a question of how these SAT-A figures were called the No Fingerprint Gang on the ground in Afghanistan. Quoting Malevich, who was, when I interviewed him, he was actually the deputy director of the U.S. Counterinsurgency Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. This is sort of the core, the brain, the inner brain of the Pentagon's counterinsurgency doctrine and so forth, and lessons learned. But he said that they're pretty envious of others in Afghanistan, so like the British, the Dutch, the Americans, and so forth. They were pretty envious of the SAT-A, and I think that was excellent about the SAT-A is the fact that unlike a lot of people who walk around Kabul and call themselves advisors, you know a lot of them are guys that are actually working at ISAF headquarters, whereas the SAT-A was actually embedded in the Afghan government. So this is we describe how this is very much an embodiment of classic counterinsurgency principles where you have the Western advisors sitting behind or whispering in the ears of the Afghan or the local officials, basically providing, in this case, an Afghan face on what is otherwise Western policy proposals. Now, just wanted to move to this question. Basically, we conclude the chapter by saying there are how counterinsurgency erodes democracy. It doesn't build democracy either in the host country, and it erodes democracy within the country that's practicing it. So we could list off hundreds of case in points of how we've seen, day by day, we see the layers peeling away from the facade of the democracy that we have here with all these releases in Ottawa and all these scandals that we see the Harper regime being embroiled in and so forth. But the question of linking these materially to the counterinsurgency war, I think, wouldn't be too difficult in many cases. But just to move on, because there's one thing about the SAT-A I wanted to highlight in relation to these other comments I wanted to make, and that is how we describe how this strategic advisory team unit was composed of civilian and military members, mostly military, but it reflected the changing nature of diplomacy. Although diplomats have traditionally taken the role of establishing relationships with foreign governments, intervention in failed states has increasingly involved the military, who forge diplomatic ties while they lend their expertise to the implementation of civilian projects. And so we've seen a number of, and in fact, I just got my hands on a a document through access information request about SAT A, sort of a description of them, where it basically wrote here that within a whole of government approach, because of course we have to situate this SAT A program and the overall counterinsurgency effort within the so-called whole of government approach, it is unlikely that the military will contribute to governance, democracy, in a similar fashion in the future. Nonetheless, the experience that has been gained through the operations of the SAT-A should not be lost. And this is a joint doctrine note written by some unit in the Canadian Forces, a lessons learned unit. Now, it's, what's quite interesting about that is, on the one hand, we can link it to, and he is not only his chapter here, you know, this concept of a single war, his other research that he did at York on the Gulf capitalist class and their emergence, and the question of internationalization of capital, but then to look at the Canadian case and how the Canadian relationship with the Gulf Cooperation Council in particular has developed along the trajectory that we see established by the strategic advisory teams. So, for example, I got some other documents through access to information request recently, which describe are basically briefing notes for one visit by the Minister of National Defense to Qatar, another for for the Chief of Defense Staff to Kuwait, what was very interesting is that just 2 days ago, buried on in the Friday headlines was this article by Lee Bertiom. National Post that talks about this secret program within the Department of National Defense called the Global Engagement Strategy, whereby you're seeing this changing nature of diplomacy acting itself out in various regions of the world, where Canada is trying to increase its impact and increase the number of relationships that it establishes at high levels with ministries of defense. And so forth. So we're seeing that in places like Brazil. We're seeing it recently in Harper's trip to Peru. They signed a memorandum of understanding with their Department of Defense. We're seeing regular high-level visits of this nature going on in a place like Kuwait, where Canada is establishing a temporary, if not permanent, military footprint along with six other locations around the world along the so-called, what do they call it, the failed state... the axis. There's a term, Thomas Barnett's term. It's escaping me at the moment, but this program is called the Operational Support Hub Unit, and this is sort of Canada's response to the changes we're seeing in the U.S. So the U.S. one of the points I wanted to make here actually was that counterinsurgency eras seem to be cyclical. So Canada, as Paul alluded to, right, Canada was not a part of the previous counterinsurgency era during Vietnam era per se. You know, Canadian complicity in the Vietnam War is very important and needs to be acknowledged and addressed and whatnot. But Canada, the apparatus and the capacities for conducting counterinsurgency warfare on the scale that they did in Afghanistan didn't exist in that era, whereas they did in this era. And then how did the U.S. transition out of the previous counterinsurgency era? We're seeing similarities with how they're transitioning out of the current counterinsurgency era in terms of shifting emphasis to special operations forces, to what they call foreign internal defense, and generalizing, maintaining this notion of as asymmetric warfare, global counterinsurgency, global war on terror, so-called, but going in and doing more sort of quiet, high-level relations, establishing these kinds of relations with defense units in various countries, and conducting warfare on a slightly different level. And Canada's, this is sort of Canada's response, operational support hubs, establishing concrete ties in the Gulf in particular, very strategic area. So this is very interesting things that I think we need to keep our eyes on, because the deepening ties between Canada and sort of what we could call the counter-revolutionary forces against the Arab revolutions and uprisings that have been going on since 2011, so more closely aligning the Canadian state and Canadian capital with Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, Qatar, these emerging powers within those regions are very, very interesting, and I think dovetail with and just sort of their extension of the chapter that we wrote. So on that note, we'll hopefully, if anyone has any questions, we can address those, but thank you very much.
Uh, I want to just make some brief remarks about the anti-war movement. But to start, Anthony was talking about the counterinsurgency doctrine of Canada. They actually produced a manual a few years back, a new counterinsurgency doctrine for Canada. And in the first edition of it, they had included indigenous populations of Canada as a target of their counterinsurgencies domestically here. And I think they had to withdraw it. It was controversial. They had to kind of say they didn't really mean they'd be waging war against indigenous people. But here we are a few years later, and we have Idle No More springing up in the past few months, in the past half year, as a huge threat to the Canadian state and a huge responsibility on all of us, including the anti-war movement, to find ways to support Idle No More and all of the questions that they're raising about indigenous sovereignty and the nature of the Canadian state. So, you know, we should always... We do always recognize we're on Coast Salish territory here in Vancouver, but I think that's no longer something we can just mention when we have our meetings, but we have to really think about the political moment we're in with Idle No More and what's coming out of that. So I would love to see... I was going to speak about the importance of the anti-war movement to actually hear from Afghans themselves, and some of you know that I worked with Malalai Joya to get her book out. She's an Afghan women's rights activist and former politician, and Stop War, we've brought her several times, and she's done tours across Canada. But it strikes me that in the past few years, we haven't found other Afghan organizations or individuals to bring to Canada and to tour, and we really should try harder to highlight those voices in Afghanistan. There's a very interesting group called the Afghan Peace Brigades, Youth Peace Brigades, volunteers, I think they sometimes go by. It's a largely anonymous group, but they have quite a presence now on the internet. And when the Occupy Wall Street movement was happening a couple years ago, a year and a half ago, they put out just a blazing statement of solidarity with Occupy Wall Street. So there are like some very courageous and politically savvy young people, especially in Afghanistan, and we should be finding more ways, I think, as an anti-war movement of bringing them here or at least bringing their message to a Canadian audience. On that note, I wanted to mention that Amal Rana, who's a Pakistani activist here in Vancouver, was supposed to be on the panel to talk about the war and its spillover into Pakistan. She came down sick today and was unable to make it. But that's one thing that wasn't covered as much in the book, but I think it's becoming increasingly important, is the war is going even further towards South Asia and really spilling over into Pakistan. It's now called the AFPAC War in a lot of the discussions from the military and from our country's leaders, and more instability is coming to Pakistan and really all of South Asia because of the war that NATO is waging. So, you know, for future discussions, we have to keep in mind the issues of Pakistan and really highlight those. One other group to mention is the Afghans United for Peace. They were called Afghans for Peace. They had a split, like groups sometimes do, and they're now called Afghans United for Peace. They were started by a couple of young women in Toronto, who I actually met the first time at the G20 protests a few years ago. It's an international network. Again, very small, but you should go and look them up, Afghans United for Peace. You know, follow them on Facebook, follow what they do on the web, and as a peace movement, we should be organizing more activities for them, finding money somewhere, you know, to bring them out here to speak, for example, because they're mostly in Toronto. And as an anti-war movement here in Vancouver, we've started to put, I would say, more of our energy, especially in the summertime, towards challenging the Canadian Forces outreach and just sort of the more and more blatant militarism that we're seeing at all the big events in the summer. So just as an example, the last few years we go out to the Dragon Boat Parade and kind of shadow the military with their tanks and just try to hand out balloons and stickers with anti-war messages. So just peacefully confronting and challenging the military there, and it always leads to fascinating discussions. And I think it even has an impact on the soldiers themselves who are sent out to do this PR. And this does link back to the Harper government, and one thing we didn't talk about that they're doing is the Harper government is not only waging a war throughout the world today, they're also waging a war on Canadian history itself. And it has an effect across the political spectrum. It's definitely not just Harper, but this is a preoccupation of his government. Vimy Ridge has become the ultimate pilgrimage. You know, next year is going to be the 100th year anniversary of the start of World War I. We can expect an absolute deluge of propaganda. If you remember, before the NDP convention a month ago or so, one of the NDP MPs got attacked by Vic Taves, the guy in charge of public safety for all of Canada, for being an anti-World War I communist apologist activist. He actually said this publicly, because it turns out that this MP, Alexandre Boulouris, before he became an MP, had written a very short article saying that World War I was a slaughter done in the name of capital, you know, for the interests of capitalism, and that only socialists and communists had opposed World War I. So Vic Taves took time out of his busy schedule, keeping Canada safe, to publicly attack the NDP for being against World War I. So we should actually take up that whole argument and challenge it and teach people the real history of Canada. I'll end on just describing because he already came up, future Prime Minister, perhaps, Justin Trudeau, driving a tank in some who knows what country. That's what Paul is predicting. And I think, you know, unfortunately, he's quite correct. Unless there's a big upsurge and change in, you know, through social movements in Canada, any future Liberal or even NDP government will follow largely a similar course, you know, with a different messaging style. But in my one conversation with Justin Trudeau, he was out at UBC campaigning for Joyce Murray in a by-election years ago. And the Liberals, he had just become an MP, and the Liberals had just voted to extend the war in Afghanistan. So I confronted him, you know, I went to shake his hand, and he gives you that grin like, this is the greatest moment of my life, because I'm meeting Justin Trudeau. That's the look he had on his face. And it took him a minute or so to realize that I was challenging him and giving him an earful about voting to continue the war in Afghanistan. And I forget his whole response, but within about 30 seconds of his response to me, explaining why he had voted for the war in Afghanistan, he started talking about Vimy Ridge, right, and how Canada had you know, become a nation by sacrificing at Vimy Ridge. And I guess what he was implying was that Canada, to stay a nation or something, had to sacrifice in Afghanistan. I don't know exactly where he was going, but the fact that someone like that, well, yeah, he didn't know either, but the fact that he would fall back on the Vimy Ridge myth, I think, points to like the importance and the power of that myth, and the importance of pointing this out. I mean, this is a hillside in France where 50,000 Canadians died in a few days, right? And hundreds of thousands of young people from all across Europe were slaughtered fighting over a few hundred meters. So I do think we really have to make an effort to next year, during the 100th anniversary of World War I, to fight that battle of history. Because World War I, you know, just the most horrific slaughter of the soldiers themselves anyway. Warfare in the last 100 years has started to take a higher and higher civilian toll, but you know, a good percentage of all of the countries involved, young people and working classes, were decimated and killed by that war. So yeah, that's my pitch for occupying World War I next year.
Thanks a lot, everyone.
And that was a talk presented at Simon Fraser University Harbor Center last month on the release of a new collection of essays called Empire's Ally. The collection takes a critical look at Canada's role in the war in Afghanistan, as well as a wider look at Canada's role in the global war on terror. Empire's Ally is published by the University of Toronto Press.